However, his piece has already set in motion the ancient forgotten tradition of summoning him, and I can't say his name anymore. I think I hit the limit. So I'm just going to call him the Sweets Man, or I'm going to like whisper it so you don't know.
Yeah.
So
I like
then
the Sweets Man, I think that's
the
fun.
The Sweets Man.
I like it, yeah.
It's different. Hi, I'm Gabe.
And I'm Kat.
And we're
the Ghouls Next Door.
And we want you to be our victim.
Yep. Say the names.
Yeah, I have bees on my face. If you're
watching.
You do
have bees on your face. And don't they look beautiful?
Yeah. I have bees on my face because we are covering Candyman, which is particularly terrifying for me. And we did a horror burlesque show where we were the host, and I was Candyman, mm-hmm. and you were Beetlejuice, and we had people try to say our names and invoke us.
Yeah, it was fun. And we looked hot, so that's another bonus for it. It was like a fun, empowering, confident time.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Well, and we talked about the original Candyman from 1992, way back when, and, you know, had very specific feelings about what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was very excited for Candyman 2020, and then it became Candyman 2021 because of times. Mm-hmm. And it With was great. It was like a fun experience because we, there was a... like we bought a theater room so that we can watch it amongst friends. Mm-hmm. So I watched it with a local cinema organization called CineSpeak, and it was great. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. It was great. I also liked it very much. I like it even more now that I've learned a bunch of stuff, but, I remember initially being like, yes. And then even more so now, like, yes, though. yeah, so I really enjoyed it. It was a really good time. And it's saying a lot, which is something that, as the Ghouls, we always very much appreciate when films be doing extra stuff, you know, giving you next steps, giving you more information.
Yeah.
So
it was incredibly intentional. It was filling a lot of the gaps that we saw when we watched the first one, just being like, why are we telling the story from this point of view? And I totally get it, because, you know, it's based off of a short story and it's not supposed to be what it is, but as we discussed in our original episode, once you place it in mm-hmm. a Black neighborhood and you are, you know, talking about gentrification, you've changed the story, and so you have to be intentional about it. And so Nia DaCosta and Monkey Paw are able to do that, which is really exciting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for those listening, The Ghouls Next Door is a media literacy show from a horror lens where we explore the real-life historical folklore reasonings behind our cinematic fears. And on this episode, we will be diving into Candyman 2021. There are spoilers ahead, of course. Mm-hmm. Because we got to talk about it. So,
yeah.
So you've been warned. I will also try to reduce the number of times I say their name. try not to invoke them. I am not in front of a mirror, so that's a benefit.
That's a benefit. Or, I mean, is a camera, but just a kind of mirror for the world.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know. I just mean, like, if you say it into the camera, it's kind of like you're spreading it, so.
yeah. And maybe we want to.
That's true, maybe too. We do That's know. A piece of it.
yeah, it definitely went from something that was a feared phrase, reasonably so, to this. When we discussed the 1992 version, I did mention that it was my first watch at the time of us recording it. It was just something I never, like, got around to watching, even being a horror buff. It was just, I had known it as this forbidden film. Like, it was just a film that most people were just like, that's the one we don't do. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. And I totally get that. And so I hope that this film is different in that. Like, it's not, like, it's not being, it's not targeting the people that the first one did. Yeah. And so I think it will, you know, expand past the level of fear that it invoked and instead let there be a moment of catharsis, hopefully.
Yeah. And I, like, part of it too is just like, it's very hard to look at lots of things that are stressful like this and face them. And even though they're like, I feel like that's what the film's doing. It's like, you're like, this is hard to process, but we got to, even if it's gruesome, even if it's like really difficult, because we don't get better without facing it. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, why don't I hop in? Let's do it.
Got it.
Let's get into it today. So we are talking about Candyman from 2021. Oof, it's like seven times already. Oh my gosh. A sequel to the horror film of 1992 that returns to the now gentrified Chicago neighborhood where the legend began, which is Cabrini Green. And it is written and directed by Nia DaCosta and produced by Jordan Peele of Monkey Paw Productions. I remember when it was first coming out, everyone was like, Jordan Peele's film. And it's like, nope, this mm-hmm. is Nia DaCosta's film. Yeah. He's just also there. He's helping for sure. But, you know, you got to give her credit. Mm-hmm. So Candyman is a sequel to the 90s folklore villain. And the film is creative with its storytelling, handling pain and grief with care. It's also captivating to watch. It has some of the similar cinematic moments that you would find in something like Get Out and Us, that like mm-hmm. topsy-turvy kind of turning us over events with the camera. We encounter the Candyman in mirrored images, where DaCosta plays with these two realities really nicely, where we reveal his menacing presence in gruesome acts and then mirror them, pun intended, with an absent foe in the real world. So yeah. Really played around with us, like, you don't see the whole vision, you don't know the whole truth unless you're looking mm-hmm. in the right place, which is the whole point of the film, was that we did not know the whole truth when we first visited Cabrini Green in the original film, and it's because we had to look in the right place. So mm-hmm. in the beginning, we revisit Cabrini Green, first catching a glimpse of the place during the time period of the first movie, and the Chicago projects are bustling with activity. After a young boy's experience with a sinister candy man, it's with a space mm-hmm. because it's a man who has candy, we are propelled into the present. And we find artist Anthony McCoy and his partner Brianna are having a dinner party with her brother and his partner. And here we are introduced to the Candyman lore, reminded of the plot of the first film following Helen Lyle. It's literally like a word for word of what happened yeah. last time. So it's like previously on, because Lyle had worked to uncover the folklore behind Candyman and its effect on the vulnerable population. However, her interpretation came from that of an outsider. And when her tale was reshaped by the minds and mouths of the residents of Cabrini Green, she was no longer the strong heroine succumbed to the charms of Tony Todd, and who could blame her? But is now the nosy white savior turned baby stealing villain who preyed upon the housing unit. It's quite a fun retelling of what happened last time.
Yeah.
From a look of the people who were there to being like, this lady just came up and did all these horrible things.
Yeah.
Versus what we had seen in the last one.
Yeah.
And the spin on the story leads to a conversation about the real horrors the people of Cabrini Green were facing, and that is gentrification. And their yeah. story of Candyman and Helen Lyle's monstrous headlines mark the community too troubled to exist, and so it has ceased since then. Artists and well-to-dos in Chicago were sweeping in to buy the land and property for cheap while pricing out the community who called the place home for generations. So it eventually succumbed to the very horrors that it was trying to fight against in the yeah. previous one. And inspired by the depressing tale of gentrification and ignoring his own part in it, because he is one of these artists who's moved in, they do, it's a weird, like, someone mentions it And there is this weird time where I think because of editing, where his partner Brianna is sometimes like conscious of and sympathetic towards some of the challenges, but then sometimes she's just like she's benefiting off of the system as well. So it's like hard. And so he's kind of, you know, he's doing what he can do. So he begins a new art installation based on the title, based on the tale titled Say My Name. And he beckons viewers to participate and call upon the entity. And as explained in the first and this one, one must only speak his name 5 times in a mirror to call him forward. And so for his installation, a mirror sits on a wall, and when opened, it reveals a complicated and graphic portrayal of black pain. And his art is scoffed at, and he eventually gets into an altercation with someone and leaves. However, his piece has already set in motion the ancient forgotten tradition of summoning him, and I can't say his name anymore. I think I hit the limit. So I'm just gonna call him the Sweets Man, or I'm gonna like whisper it so you don't
Yeah,
know.
I
So
like
then
the sweets man. I think that's
the
a fun.
Sweets Man.
I like it,
It's
yeah.
different. Now the sleeping beast is reawakened by a horny art assistant, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
She says name, and then oops, now he's here. And what a crazy scene. It was so cool. Like it, that's like one of the scenes that really stood out to me of using the mirror and then using real life, because it's
Yeah.
like in the mirror you see him come up and slit her throat, but then you're seeing them and there's nobody there. It was
Yeah.
so cool. Like that stuff was like awesome. Like he couldn't be handed a better story.
Yeah.
So after a visit to the now desolate Cabrini Green, McCoy meets William Burke, a previous resident of Cabrini and the boy who saw the guy with candy in the beginning.
Yeah.
It is here we learn something important about the Sweets Man. Burke reveals more of the story that we had seen in the beginning, and like Helen Lyle's experience, we had only a limited view to work with, which influenced our interpretations of the events. So
Yeah.
we had seen in the beginning a young boy afraid of this man with candy screaming before cutting away. So he had like gone down to do some laundry. There was this creepy hole in the wall, and this Sweets Man came out of the wall and he screamed. So we thought, oh, this clearly something horrible happened to this young boy because of the
Yeah.
Sweets Man. But no, turns out that Burke explains that after the initial scream, it was generally one of surprise, just like, oh, there's a guy on the wall.
Yeah.
There you are. And not expecting demise. Like he wasn't actually afraid for his life. He's given candy by the nice man before returning up to the stairs. But he had explained that his Sweets Man was this man, who's named Sherman.
Yeah.
Because this man would give would often give children candy in the neighborhoods. And recently, Sherman has been hiding and on the run after a razor blade was found in a white child's candy
Yeah.
wrapper. Which, as like a side note, the real folklore of like the razor blades in the candy, or just like candy being bad, is based off of a real situation in which a white man laced these big pixie sticks, like the ones that were in like the rubbery
Yeah.
tubes, plastic tubes, with like arsenic or rat poison or something, and he gave it to his son and his son's friend, and then like was like, oh, someone did it,
Yeah,
but it was
it
him.
was him,
So
yeah.
clearly, just like how everyone was running around trying to figure out who it was, they're not going to blame this white father.
Yeah.
So Sherman is the expected culprit. And so when Burke had that initial scream of surprise, it had alerted the police to Sherman's location, resulting in them murdering him. They thought they were saving the day. Or did they? You
Yeah.
know, they just thought they were doing their job. And they, you know, expected him to be the villain. And then it's obviously discovered that he was not. Because then another kid had razors and he wasn't around.
Yeah.
So with this, it's like at first we had been led to believe that Sherman was a villain and that he had scared young Burke and intended harm to him. Now we're shown the truth and we see that not only his innocence, but also the cruelty he suffered due to the same limited point of view. And instead, the fear that Burke as a child is experiencing isn't from Sherman showing up through the wall. It's from the police brutality.
Yeah.
Like, it's the real fear. Burke then goes on to explain that the Sweets Man is not a singular man at all, instead saying, Candyman is not a he. Candyman is the whole damn hive. Because he is not one villainous man, but rather a history of men. He is an idea, a trauma, an inherited pain, and word of caution. The Sweets Man is each black man who was wrongfully accused of a crime and murdered for it. And the Sweets Man is generational trauma made manifest. And in this revelation, this more distinct ownership of him as a folkloric protector elevates him from the limited interpretation of the first film. It is for this point that I really appreciated the film, because it was it was specifically addressing an issue that I had with the first one. And we, talked about that in our first episode. So director and writer DaCosta explains the depth of Sugarman's influence and her intention in making this film, saying, Candyman is so perennial. We're talking about the cycles of violence and how history repeats itself and how we collectively process trauma through stories. It's always time to tell a story like Candyman, which is the big tragedy about the tale in the first place. Yeah. And, I think it's something to, there's a meta aspect to that too, in the fact that this is a film, right? That we're using the film to live through and air through some of these horrors.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what folklore is. Like, folklore has adapted from, the word of mouth, these tales of caution that you would, tell kids so that they don't go into the woods and to danger. Instead, it is now transformed into these films that are used to be those words of caution, to be the story that tells you not to go into the woods because it's dangerous. And so this film is the revitalization of the folklore of Candyman. I just really love that part about it. And it is a way to, like she said, collectively process trauma through telling the story and giving it a name. And so the rest of the film follows McCoy as he spirals, followed by the entity and seemingly becoming him. And as an artist, he had attempted to create something from the pain to essentially do what this film is doing, right? But through his art. And it was called cliche by a critic. And even when he first pitches the idea, they're like, that's old news. Yeah. Or when he tries to pitch his original idea, they're like, that's old news. And then he has to transform it into this something that's more poppy, something that will grab people's attentions. Like, even what he feels is the right way to convey what he's feeling isn't enough for the audience that he's reaching out to. He created that piece that gets mocked anyway. When the Sweets Man is killing off idiots who dare speak his name, this critic pivots and invites McCoy in for an exclusive interview. It was so rude. She was all of a sudden oh, it's interesting now. She's interested in this work because now it's tied directly to violence on white bodies specifically. Yeah. Before, when you were telling the history and present day pain that black people are experiencing, oh, that's old news. We don't, everyone talks about it. We don't need to keep talking about it, which is obviously echoing what people are saying about the film in itself. Any critic who's just elevated horror.
Yeah.
She's literally them.
And the whole thing is maybe don't erase the history that was traumatic, that white people did. Stop trying to erase it. Say it for what it was.
Yeah.
She's that's exactly. Old news. That seems a lot, and I just don't want to. And then when she can benefit from it, she's heck yeah.
Yeah, it's okay, we get it, we know, okay, and we can put it behind us, and we could do something new, something spunky, and then it's oh no, white people died, now we need to talk about it, now it's sensational, now it's something, now I care. And she asked him about his work around gentrification, his motives, and then his experiences in the hood, to which he responds vehemently, Who do you think makes the hood? The city cuts off a community and waits for it to die. Then they invite developers in and say, hey, you artists, you young people, you white, preferably or only, please come to the hood. It's cheap. And if you stick it out for a couple of years, we'll bring you a Whole Foods. It's literally what's happening. And it's what's happening in our own neighborhoods quite often here in Philadelphia. So, you know, gentrification was a strong critique in the first one, and that follows through in the sequel. Only the story is elevated from a distant view and instead drops us into the community directly. So it was like this white woman coming in and being like, what's everyone's problem? This is so cute that this is how you guys are dealing with this. Isn't it adorable how they still believe in, like, this folklore monster? Like, Helen, what are you, like, it was so insane. They definitely dabbled on gentrification, for sure. But this film was like, okay, we're just going to call it like it is because we have to call it like it is. But that's not really what we want to talk about. Like, yeah, that sucks, but that is only, but, like, it is a symptom of the root cause, essentially. Like, it's just another thing that we're experiencing, but there is something else here that is at work that is insidious. So because for them, gentrification is a direct evil and tied to the systemic pain enacted on Black and poor communities. But the larger picture evolves away from this one aspect of the trauma in the Cabrini-Green legacy. It just takes it from there. So as a teaser for the film, one of the trailers released featured shadow puppets that were these recreations of the stories that Burke will share later in the film, and some others that aren't overtly spoken about, but you see them in the credits. And they are based on real life instances of Black men being harmed and punished for crimes they did not commit. And you're welcome to look it up. They are real, they have existed, and I don't feel like talking about them. Because you could just watch the puppet show and know that those things are real, except for Tony Todd's character from last time. All the other ones are very real, and it's gross. It hurts. So go watch it. But this exploration of the character was creative, and it finally addressed some of the complaints that I had about the first one, like I explained. So actor Yahya Abdul-Mateen, who plays Anthony McCoy, and also is in Watchmen, so I was like, agreed that this shift from Helen's perspective to that of the community members affected was really important and vital to the story. And in an interview with Digital Spy, he said, I'm really happy that this film is talking about the subject of unwilling martyrs and the trauma placed on the bodies of the Black community and the trauma within the Black experiences at the hand of white violence and what we can do with that. So very appreciative that we're no longer following this white woman. It's like, oh, it's so quaint. So for Lyle, Tony Todd's villain was singular. He was a monster that she had to reckon with or succumb to. And for people like McCoy and Burke, the character was instead a catharsis. So Burke explains that Candyman is a way to deal with the fact that these things happen to us, are still happening. And further, after sharing the story of specifically Tony Todd's Candyman and all the other ones, saying a story like that, a pain like that, lasts forever, right? It has a toll. It has an impact on the community. It has an impact on the earth, on the very place that it took place, right? So the tale transforms here into a way for this community to put a word to their pain. It is no longer about a villain terrorizing an already vulnerable community, but instead something to point to separate themselves from and move forward. How else could you put generations of pain and injustice into words? Instead of, like, you make it into this boogeyman so that you can tell people, like, you can tell the younger generations what to fear and how to be alert, right? While also, what was that?
I said for safety,
Yeah, for safety, exactly. And to, so that you can also kind of separate yourself too. Like, it becomes the story, we've spoken it into existence, and now we can go to the next thing, right? But we can still use it as a tool to do it. So we have seen the true monster change shape throughout history in our world, right? From militias hunting runaway enslaved people to the modern day police force that are continuing that harm. And the pain and the stain on environments like Cabrini Green is deep. It's been festering and it's insidious and it's tormented by the cyclical violence on Black bodies. So the history of the Candy Men acts as an echo, like a haunting in our country that isn't going anywhere if we don't learn to speak its name and to speak truth to power. Which is why it's so cool. Like, I know people hate on it because they're like, and I will say, the end felt like there was some editing things going on. Like, all of a sudden we were doing this other thing, and I felt like the beginning was such a slow burn into this, like, descent, and then all of a sudden, like, McCoy was just, like, in it. And then I was like, but what's happened with Brianna? She got a lot of trauma she's dealing with. And I was really appreciative of her character setting boundaries and sticking to them and being like, no, it is not my job to fix you. Which they do not often get that ability to do, especially in film, but in real life, like, the ability to be like, that is not my job. I don't have to. And for my safety, for my sanity, I'm gonna step away from that. And it's not like a place of hate, right? It's not like, oh, you're awful, like, I hate you now. It was, I care for you a lot, but I still can't do that. Like, give them some grace for that. So but I just feel like towards the end it did feel a little like stressed. Like, what are we doing? I wish we could have spent a little more time, and maybe even for the dummies like me, some, you know, narration. Like, that was a little more like on the nail on the head. I mean, it pretty much is, like, it is very unsubtle. But I don't know, I was just like, what's happening?
Helps, you know?
Yeah.
In general, it's just helpful. The more information you have, the better.
Yes. Tanana Reeve contextualizes this taking back of the folklore in a discussion that served as an accompaniment of the film titled Candyman, the Impact of Black Horror, saying, really, what was fueling a lot of the fear around him, being the sweets man, was the fear of Black masculinity, Black men, fear of the urban jungle. I mean, Cabrini Green itself is a monster. Really, some of the worst stereotypes around Blackness. So it was very important for Nia DaCosta and Monkey Paw to come and reframe a story about Black trauma through a Black lens, not through a white one. And it absolutely transforms the story. It gives the power to different people. And again, it becomes less of like this tourist, like this like dark tourist moment, right? Where, oh, we can just dabble in danger and then go to our safety. Like, we don't know. So in the end of the film, McCoy successfully revives the folkloric monster, but this time transforming him into a weapon for justice. And Burke creates this, or organizes this attack on McCoy, influencing his murder by police, which turns him into a new sweets man, because now he has suffered violence from the same people who... Yeah. I've been doing the violence this whole time. So then later, Brianna speaks his name, invoking him as that weapon for protection against the true villains, the police. And she is told to continue this story to tell everyone and spread the tale of Candyman so that he can live on. Only now he is no longer a symbol of fear, but instead a symbol of vengeance.
I know. One, that was a lot because you're tired, but also because, like, a lot just mental, it's heavy stuff to process, and, you know, it is a lot to unpack, and you did so lovely. You did intentional and wonderful, so thank kudos. But yeah, I'm gonna kind of unpack specifically the resources that the film shares out at the end. That's going to be the bulk of my section. It's my entire section, if I'm being very honest. I just was how cool that the film at the end, you get in the last credits and it's like, go here to learn more. And I'm like, you got it.
That's exactly what we're about.
Yeah. And I was just like, what a wonderful way to use one, like, this movie that, like, a lot of people went to go see in theaters. You know what I mean? Like, it was the name itself did a lot of the work for, but I will say, like, some of the resources I did notice, like, didn't have a lot of views on YouTube. Like, that makes me mad. So I extra want to highlight them because it is something that was like at the last little section of the movie that if like you left right away, or you just like were on your phone because you're like the movie's done, or you just like weren't looking up at the right time, it's only there for a few seconds. So I thought, like, what a better way to cover what this film was trying to do by highlighting the resources the film provides. So I'm gonna get into it. So essentially, as Gabe gave our whole overview of Nia DaCosta's Candyman 2021, but it does something that we love to see, and it gives viewers next steps, as well as just like a really interesting website that had like a ton of resources, highlighted artists, creatives, advocates, and like the impact that they're making. In the closing credits, in case you missed it, they provide a link, and the link is candymanmovie.com/impact. And in that link, you find like just a lot of resources. There's a wonderful, the YouTube video that Gabe mentioned that I just so highly recommend, because it just was, as I said, I love context. The more context I have, the better. And it just gave a little extra context that I just thought was really great. It's also just like people talking about it in a way that was like really interesting. And highly recommend that. But essentially, when you do go into this link, you find an array of information, all relevant to the film, as well as history. And it's something that, you know, I didn't want people to miss. They didn't want you to miss. Because as they say throughout the entire thing, tell everyone. That's what they want the audience to do. They want people to talk about Candyman. So also, I will say something that is always important, I think, when discussing these kinds of things. If you don't want to hear me say stuff about it, that's totally, the resource is there. We're going to link it in the blog. I'm also going to highlight it on screen. If you want to mute me and just read it, go for it. Like, honestly, I am going to read a lot of just the words from it. So if you don't want to hear me say it, that's totally good. And if you want to hear other people talk that are not me, the Impact of Black Horror video is great. Totally recommend. It just kind of unpacks Candyman more, the story, the legend, as well as like the general generational trauma that influenced the film and the impact everything all has. So like they really get into it, and honestly, it's a really great resource to watch and listen to if you don't want to, if you want to listen to me, but you also don't want to be listening to me, go do both. So essentially, I just really appreciated that the film, in collaboration with like so many nonprofit organizations, leaders, experts, and advocates, gave the audience such clear and intentional next steps. I think that's something like, as the ghouls, we just always love to see, because that's what we try to do within our platform, is like, we watch this film, here are things that you can do. If it's work, have learned something heavy, like these are your next steps. And it did that work for us, which is just like lovely. So first I'll unpack the official companion guide. I actually have it here. So fancy. And essentially I was going to go through each resource. If you would just like to read it, I say go for it. But essentially in this companion guide, they just go through a lot of really great information. They go over it as a way to help audiences go deeper into the themes of Candyman, and that Monkey Paws production and Universal Pictures collaborated with the Langston League, an educational curriculum firm that specializes in culturally responsive instruction materials, to create the official, you know, companion guide and exploration of themes, with special insight from educators Professor Tana Nariv-Du and Professor John Jennings. This tool helps fans explore the legend of Candyman and Black culture. The guide opens up with a statement that reinforces why I chose to highlight it during my section, and it gives the instruction to tell everyone. It says, "This guide is a tool of your own making. Do with it as you wish, quote it, debate it, highlight it, write in it, devour the resources. The guide grants you access to the innermost thoughts of educators of Black history, genre experts, and the horror obsessed. We've immersed ourselves in the reclamation of Candyman, and we have quite a lot to say. Tell everyone." And they sign it off, the Langston League. And there's a few sections within this. If we have time, I'll go through all of them. If we don't, then I'll get through as much as I can and then encourage you to do, you know, reading on your own. But the curriculum throughout is created in collaboration, as I said, with the Langston League, an organization that operates as a multi-consultant curriculum firm that specializes in designing culturally relevant instructional material at the intersection of Black history and pop culture for multi-generational students. And essentially, this is where I divert a little bit from the guide, because I like went off and I looked at all the organizations that they reference and give just like a little extra context for them. So on their website, they offered a few other companion guides for the films. They have one for Lovecraft Country. They have one for something called The Big Payback, and a project called Wakanda Unscripted, which is a free two-part guide for Black and Latinx curriculum designers exploring STEM connections to Marvel's Black Panther franchise. As a newer organization, they started these collaborations in 2016, and their website has links to other resources, like, for example, their YouTube channel that's educational and titled Decolonized, and it is a YouTube series featuring history instruction designed to be a flexible resource for aspiring and current late elementary and middle school grade students. Decolonized provides students, families, and stakeholders with various strategies for closely examining, questioning, and analyzing primary sources. So if you go into the little link that I provide in the blog, they have a whole overview of like a curriculum that any educator could use if they would like to. It was free and on there. So it seems like they're doing a lot of work just to like further information and educational resources, and in their collaboration with Monkey Paw Productions and Nia DaCosta in Candyman, they've created something really cool. So to get back to the curriculum, the guide itself opens up with a foreword by Professor Tananarive Due, who is an American author, executive producer of horror noir, a history of Black horror at UCLA, and a lecturer. She is best known for the film historian and expertise in Black horror, and Nia DaCosta's Candyman could be titled, as they say in this, Candyman Reclamation. They say a reclamation of our story, a reclamation of our history, a reclamation of our trauma. And in adapting Clive Barker's short story, The Forbidden, which takes place in Liverpool, as an examination of urban myths and classism, 1992's Candyman transplanted the story to a struggling community in the United States, specifically Chicago's Cabrini-Green housing project. DaCosta's Candyman is a genuinely terrifying film that both asks and answers questions such as, what is the impact of generational and community trauma? What is the relationship between art and trauma? What hauntings result when an entire community becomes a ghost? And how do you depict Black fears without re-traumatizing audiences or creating fear of Blackness? Some of these questions are actually answered in the video that I mentioned before, if you do wanna ever check that out. And it's just like a really interesting conversation. So after the foreword, we get the first section of the guide that's titled Section 1, Myth and Folklore. And this stretches from pages 10 to 18. They go through kind of like why and like how the story is established and like why it was so important to like restage it and retell it from this lens. So at the beginning of the film, Troy Carthright sets the stage in a way the diaspora is used to. In a moment of collectivism surrounded by a family and friends, he encircles the group to tell the tale of a grad student doing anthropological work around Chicago's Cabrini-Green housing project. He is passing down a story to unknowing peers, a practice bestowed upon us through a Mande Empire in Mali and Africa and beyond. At first, it appears that Troy is Candyman's griot, a storyteller or oral historian that preserves our stories like traditions and traditions. By candlelight, he weaves the myth of Helen Lyle, a woman said to have snapped and taken several Black lives and a Rottweiler. As we resume the film, we realize that Troy is a participant in a game of telephone, mistakenly identifying Helen as a serial killer in an urban legend of Candyman. The story's griot is truly William Burke, as played by Coleman Domingo, a connoisseur of the spin cycle at the laundromat, what feels like a metaphor for Candyman's iterations and generational trauma. William's exposure to Candyman's legacy at an early age establishes an understanding of the story's need to be told. We realize that Candyman isn't just an urban legend, but a warning to be taken seriously, a culmination of real tragedies that have happened throughout Candyman's Cabrini-Green history. Stories that would go untold without generations remembering to tell everyone. Candyman is how we deal with the fact that these things happened and they are still happening. with the intention of preserving all the original messages and to avoid a kind of telephone whisper down the lane situation. That's why I'm really just reading from what is being said. I don't want to misquote anybody. I don't want to say the wrong thing because I recognize that my lens is not the lens that needs to be telling the story. So essentially, I'm doing a lot of direct quotes, and I highly recommend reading it yourself. The guy continues on with Zora Neale Hurston in Troy Carthwaite's recounting of Helen Lyle's demise. He notes that she came to Cabrini Green asking questions and taking pictures of graffiti and people. Lyle's work, noted here in the original movie, is very much like the three-walled room that author and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston speaks of. Hurston defines many Black American spaces as rooms with one wall missing, exposing their lives to the white man's intentions and inspection. In February of 1927, Hurston made her way to the Gulf States to preserve our stories through community griots. With a pistol in tow and a car named Sassy Susie, Hurston navigated the Jim Crow South, collecting the songs, stories, dances, and traditions of Black people. Hurston's work began in Eatonville, Florida, a self-governed Black town from which she hailed, and she described Eatonville as a four-walled room, a space mostly bereft of outside interference. Antithesis of Helen Lyle, Hurston's preserving of our stories exemplified our self-determination, centering our full selves, dialect, folklore, collectivism, and all. Works such as Barracoon and Every Tongue's Got to Confess are living legacies to this work. And that's a direct organization of quote from the Langston League. The guy continues and highlights work from W.E.B. Du Bois in a recorded autobiography and his reflection on the disturbing acts of violence that were inflicted upon a real Black man named Sam Haas. Du Bois' recollection of this experience in the market highlighted within the above-linked audio clip, the guide says, shows us that Candyman's original story, which also involves a lynching and severing of an arm, is a real American horror story. So as much as Gabe was saying, the things showed in like the puppet shows and lore used throughout the story are based on real things that happened. And the using the art to continue to just acknowledge that it happened, as they said, say their names and acknowledge that like lots of horrible things have happened. So the guy goes on to highlight a nonprofit organization called the Confess Project that aims to support mental health in Black men and boys using a barbershop as a resource and setting. In my blog, I do link this, and if you do download the guide, there is a link at the bottom of the overview of what the Confess Project does. But they're doing really amazing work, specifically using barbershops as a place to distribute therapy resources. They go on to say that barbershops are pertinent to Black communities and are often a space of lively social interactions, storytelling, and healing camaraderie. Having conversations while grooming brings calmness to many, in which barbers are centered as healers too. The Confess Project Coalition exemplifies this cultural tradition with this mission. And the Confess Project is committed to building a mental health culture for boys, men of color, and their families through the capacity building, advocacy, organizing, and movement building. We believe in a world without barriers to stigma and shame. The organization prides itself on being an America's first mental health barbershop movement, in which they offer to train those interested in becoming barbers and equip them with the necessary tools related to mental health advocacy. In addition, barbers are taught the importance of active listening, positive communication, validation, and how to reduce mental health stigma when servicing and interacting with clients. On their website, they have linked resources that I'll also highlight here within the blog for mental health services that are kind of like more inclusive, specifically not just focusing on Black men, but also Black women, LGBTQIA individuals, the National Queer and Trans Therapists of Color Network, as well as many others and just resources that exist. So I have linked that in our blog if you're interested. And as it continues, the Langston League and Companion Guide interviews the Confess Project's founder. They're also actually in the video that we mentioned before and speak about Candyman. And I'm not going to read the entire interview, but there's one point where in interviewing Lorenzo Lewis, they discuss the future goals of the organization and As a direct quote, they say, in the next 3 years, our goal is to train 5,000 barbers, and at the end of this year, we would have trained 1,000. Right now, we're pushing the Road to 1 Million campaign, and we're in partnership with Gillette. We want to reach 1 million people by the end of December 2021, because I'll need to find out if they did, because that's a past quote. But with 1,000 barbers, each of those barbers can reach up to 100 clients per month. Our goal is to reach people through the training of advocacy, conversations, and the dialogue in the barber's chair. We've also been able to partner with Harvard University and have done research with them over the last year to show how barbers are becoming mental health gatekeepers, especially in this racial distrust era of COVID-19. They close out the section of the companion guide with a prompt and space to write, which was really cool. They give like an overview of the terms that they've mentioned throughout so that you have like definitions to go off of. And they also offer you a space and a prompt to write out words, stories, phrases, myths, legends, griots that hold meaning to the viewer. So if you want to experience this guide in earnest, you can download it at the link that we provide. And also it's just like cool that you get like kind of like unstructured homework, like it is structured, but like, you know, it's self-driven and it gives you a space like to record what means something to you, which, as the entire point of the story of Candyman is like to preserve legacies and like speak on the things that matter to you. So they give you a space, two. So you get 2 pages where you can just like write what's important to you. And that's pretty cool. In section 2, exploring gentrification in Candyman and beyond, they provide an image that is important to what I'm going to say next and kind of go through gentrification and displacement. So they say a few years ago, the Langston League held a workshop in a neighborhood that had very few Black residents. The school was emphatic about the urgency of teaching decolonized Black history to their students. After discussing ways to surface history in their area with students, a teacher raised her hand and said, "This is a historically white neighborhood. We would have difficulty finding Black history here." On our way to the school, we noticed an African Methodist Episcopal church a few blocks away. The church was established in the 1800s. Based on several of our history research trips, we know that where there is an AME church, there are Black people and Black history. The presence of Black churches has always been evidence of our roots in a community. And the hand in this picture, their name is Anthony. Anthony holds up an outdated image of the Missionary Baptist Church in Cabrini Green. The mural once painted above is the door depicts imagery of diverse peoples alongside names of figures who are synonymous with tragedy and triumph, Malcolm X, Anne Frank, Dr. King, and more. The mural was painted in 1972 by a prominent Black muralist and Chicagoan named William Walker. It was a piece heralded up until its very last moment when preservationists discovered it had been whitewashed by painters. The church's whitewashing feels like a metaphor for our continued displacement at the hands of urban renewal, development, induced displacement, and gentrification. It is a reminder of our continued erasure despite mounting evidence that we have always been here and always will be. And they continue, they basically say, Little Hell, Smoky Hollow, Combat Alley, Cabrini Green, helping us keeping us safe or keeping us inside. I can't read today, and that's fine. They go on to highlight a Chicago-based artist, and that's something that they do on their website that's just like really cool. They highlight a ton of artists on their website, so if you're looking for like cool art, it is on there, as well as like they highlight a lot of real artists within the film that I'm also going to get into. But in this section they highlight a Chicago-based artist named Phenom, and he calls Cabrini Green homes the Greens. The metaphor isn't lost on us as he describes how each distinct neighborhood on Cabrini Green's map takes its own shape and assists or hinders its residents' growth. Phenom describes the communities different from the glimpse we see in Candyman in the following quote. So he says, as a kid in Cabrini Green, you're not focused on the violence. We saw grandmothers, aunties, people getting in motion to head to the grocery store to celebrate holidays. Everybody was living and ready for the feast. When it was good, it was really good. And when it was bad, it was really bad. Phenom then emphasizes that while some days were tough, even remembering a Halloween moment with the parents fearing razor blades and trick-or-treat candy, the fear fueled the community's defense. As a result, families became overprotective, rummaging through candy bags and ensuring kids traveled in herds and made them closer. Everything, as he goes on to say, everything was in four block radius. My school, my church, my girlfriend, my best friend, my grandparents on both sides, and my aunties and uncles. Phenom describes a daily routine, bouncing from house to house, collectivism, and a care all around him and others. He says that his favorite memory is his uncle, whom many respected and feared throughout the neighborhoods, an uncle who would stop to wipe his nose if he thought it was runny. He was presumably a good man and a big dude. He had a soft side, so that's important too. And Phenom continues to say that he channels the community care he felt in Cabrini-Green and his work as an MC, educator, poet, and leader. A major part of Phenom's life work is a Chicago-based organization he founded for young MCs, aptly named MC School. MC School's objective is to develop a social creative arts initiative designed to strengthen young teaching artists in the fundamentals of becoming sustainable and impactful assets in their community and family via organizing through the arts. In addition, MC School serves as a restorative justice and violence prevention strategy. As it continues on, we get actually some history of Cabrini-Green, which I honestly didn't know a lot of this stuff, so I thought it was really interesting. They kind of go, it's like little tiny bits of information, but you know, it's still context that I didn't have before. So they say in the 1850s, the area acquires nicknames such as Little Hell and Smoky Hollow because of the factories established there that were often surrounded by flames or smoke. By the 1890s, the area becomes known as Little Sicily due to a large population of Italian immigrants. The 1940s, the Francis Cabrini houses were built. They are row homes with 584 units and 54 buildings. By the 1950s, the Cabrini-Green extension is built, made up of red brick mid-high rises with 1925 units and 15 buildings. By 1960, the William Green homes were built in 1962. There were 1,096 units. The lawsuit, Gautreau et al. Versus Chicago Housing Authority, is filed, stating that CHA's public housing program was racially segregated. By the 1990s, Cabrini-Green begins a plan to demolish standing spaces and replace them with mixed-income communities. The first Candyman is filmed in the towers. And then 2021, the new Candyman is in theaters, having been delayed because of the COVID-19 pandemic, and it features former Cabrini-Green homes. As they continue to go on, this is where it starts to get just like super interesting. It was already interesting, but then like they really get into like historical stuff that I just thought was really cool. So the world is familiar with Lorraine Hansberry's work and legacy, especially her play A Raisin in the Sun. However, many people don't know that the play, named after the line of the Langston Hughes A Dream Deferred poem, was inspired by her parents' fight against Chicago's discriminatory housing practices. In 1937, while most Black Chicago residents were restricted to Chicago's Black Belt due to the racially restrictive covenants, Hansberry's father purchased a home in and then all-white area of Chicago called Woodlawn. After his purchase, white residents took the Hansberry family to court, demanding their departure from the neighborhood. Despite this, the Hansberry family stood their ground and continued to stay in the house during attacks on their home and property. In addition, Carl Hansberry patrolled the home at night with a loaded handgun to keep his family safe. The Hansberry versus Lee court case made it all the way to the United States Supreme Court, where the court ruled in favor of the Hansberry family. The prosecution did not have the 95% of the required signatures to enforce a racially restrictive covenant. While the court case didn't change discriminatory practices for the nation, it showed many that it would one day be possible to end legal housing segregation. And as it just, I don't have a lot of time left, so I'm going to start to rush through this, but it continues on and we get more from specifically Ida B. Wells. And the thing that's highlighted right in the corner is white people built the ghetto and then erased it when they realized they built the ghetto. So a lot of what we see happen is that there's a lot of erasure that takes place throughout history, specifically of white people trying to erase the bad things that they've done. So They go on to say Nia DaCosta's Candyman helps us reconsider what urban renewal and redevelopment really have to offer Black communities everywhere, especially when considering Black residents in Chicago. When we think of the original Candyman, Daniel Robitaille's story, we are reminded by William that before the creation and demolition of the Cabrini Green housing projects, Robitaille's murder and execution took place upon the same grounds where the high rises once stood, a site of trauma constantly built on and built over under the guise of redevelopment. For example, look at the Ida B. Wells Holmes name, named after the Mississippi-born investigative journalist and freedom fighter herself. Wells spent her life speaking out against the injustices of Black people throughout her writing, focusing on the horrors of lynching in the American South through their anti-lynching campaign. Following the death of her friend, Thomas Moss, Wells became interested in the tactic of white mob violence and the use of lynching as a tool of terrorism and intimidation. And in 1892, she published her pamphlet, Southern Horrors, Lynch Law and All of Its Phases, which resulted in the destruction of her printing press in Memphis and her eventual relocation to Chicago, where she would remain until her death in 1931. About 8 years after Wells' death, the Ida B. Wells Home, or Wellstown, were created in response to years of protests and campaigns for affordable housing in Chicago's Bronzeville neighborhood. Unfortunately, the start of the 1980s, the Ida B. Wells Home became susceptible to negligence from the housing authorities, intercommunal violence, and policies enforced to create vacant properties, a fate that would befall many area housing projects, including Cabrini Green. If we think of ghosts of the past as site-specific, as Professor John Jennings would say, then it forces us to reconsider those whose shoulders are we standing on. And in the case of Candyman, how literal or figurative might this question be? I will say I'll end my exploration of this there because we are basically out of time. But if you want to keep going into it goes into more history specifically about the history of Black Chicago. It was apparently founded, the first settler of Chicago, Illinois, was a Black man. That's something I didn't know. His name was Jean-Baptiste Pont du Sable, and was founder of a trading settlement, landowner and immigrant from Haiti. So it kind of just gives you a bunch of like facts that are really cool. and it just continues to outline and highlight nonprofit organizations and activists that are like actively doing work to bring positive change to the world, and also just like educate and spread awareness. So the last one I'll mention is BEAM, because that's the last one that I will have. It's essentially Black Emotional and Mental Health Collective. A lot of these resources are centered around mental health, reasonably so, because a lot of existing in America is very traumatic, especially for BIPOC humans. So mental health resources are definitely a really great asset and something that they like highlight throughout the work. The last thing I recommend within the guide is to really focus in on the artists, because the artists that are in the film are like real artists making really cool art in the world, and the website and the guide highlights and gives names to each of them. So do recommend checking that out if you just want to know, like, you saw the art and you're like, that was really cool, like, very genuinely, that was dope art. You want to know who made it? They really go through that for you, and you can find that in the blog
as well. That is so cool. It's great for, like, you know, they're, you know, talking the talk, but they're walking the walk.
Yeah.
And I think that's so cool.
And, like, they have a huge platform, and they're using that platform for good. So, like, it's dope.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting topic, like, specifically of gentrification in horror. Like, we've been seeing a lot of those commentaries coming through with, you know, Candyman, Vampires versus the Bronx.
Yeah.
You know, Attack the Block, even. Barbarian, we talked about that, too. It's clearly something that people are struggling with and upset about. And so it's really helpful to have this point of catharsis for, like, with the film, but then also then having, like, action items that follow it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, definitely let us know what you think about Candyman.
Yeah.
We know that, we know it was great, but I know some people who feel certain things. I'd say definitely check out those videos if you were feeling any type of way about the film, and just re-center yourself and think about what it is covering, and that might help to better understand the film and appreciate it on a different level. I do think it would be nice, like, you know, we were asking for like the Snyder cut of like a stupid film that we didn't need a Snyder cut of. I want to see like the DaCosta cut of like I want the extended version where we actually get to sit with all these characters and go through it, because I feel like there's some things missing. And so yeah, release the DaCosta cut.
You heard it here. We must receive it. We must know. That's funny. And I'll say it one more time. Go read it yourself, because like I'm not a great public speaker. We do have a podcast. I say words sometimes, but I don't do it justice. And I just think you really should read it yourself, and it's good. So last time I say it, go read it.
Yeah, you can find those resources on our blog and in our show notes. I'll also link to some of the other reviews so you can do your own research as well, just about the folklore of Candyman and also some of the gentrification conversations that could be had, so that you can do your own research and always keep going. Yeah, and I would say look up movers and shakers, community organizers in your own area to see how you can help combat gentrification where you live. We're in the midst of our Horrors of Society series. It's gonna be like this, it's gonna
It's
keep on
gonna be
going, but it's
horrors,
all
and it's
good.
gonna be
It's all
society,
good.
and we're doing it.
Society be societying. So don't get
Enjoy
married.
your kids. Yeah,
Okay.
I don't have a
Yeah, I don't
quirky
have any. I
little
don't want to
quip
say
or
anything
anything.
else.